WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 4 of Pulse of the Nation. And if this episode is going on a Friday, you know what that means. It's time to return to our news flashes, bringing you the biggest political news stories over the past week. And before we want to start, a poll just came out on the time of recording in New Hampshire. It's a CNN University of New Hampshire poll, and the results are kind of hilarious. Obviously, Donald Trump is in first place at 39%. A blind snail could have probably predicted that one, let me be completely honest. But second through fifth, there's only a 3% difference between the second place and the fifth place candidates. Vivek Ramaswamy is in second at 13%, Nikki Haley in third with 12%, Chris Christie in fourth place with 11%, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in fifth place with 10%. Tim Scott, the South Carolina senator, is at 6% in sixth place. Mike Pence is in seventh at 2%, and it's just laughable from there. So again, Donald Trump should pretty easily win New Hampshire, but there is a significant not Trump vote. However, the fact that the second place candidate in this poll is just the Indian version of Donald Trump should probably give anti-Trump Republicans some pause as to what the party base actually wants, which is generally not going to be Chris Christie. I'm just tell you that right now. So on to the other news stories of the week, and I think we'll get this one out of the way because it's kind of obvious. United Auto Workers, they are on strike, not just in Wentzville, Missouri, not just in Wayne, Michigan, not just in Toledo, Ohio, where, you know, they're striking against the big three automakers and essentially having the slogan of record profits equaling record contracts. Essentially, that is their goal. They are also striking right here in the city of Tuscaloosa. About 190 workers are striking at a CF plant, which makes axles for Mercedes Benz cars and vehicles, and they struck as of Wednesday. I think they started the strike actions, and they're also wanting an end to the tiered system of payments, as well as, you know, the whole record profits, record or contracts thing. They're trying to, what the tiered system is essentially older employees get more pay than younger employees, and UAW wants to end that across the nation. So just wanted to bring that to your attention as it is happening. We may talk about this more on the news flash, or may give you a specific episode about the United Auto Workers and why it will be on Pulse of the Nation. Well, it's because as of right now, as of recording, there are deliberations over whether President Joe Biden should go to the picket lines and join the workers on the picket lines. And there's been a lot of debate over that. I think White House advisors like Steve Ricchetti, whose brother is apparently a lobbyist for General Motors, apparently Ricchetti might not want him to go. But, you know, Union President Sean Fain said, you know, people always welcome picket lines and stuff like that. There's a lot of deliberations on that, especially because former President Donald Trump, instead of heading to the second GOP debate in Simi Valley, California, at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, he is apparently going to be making a speech in Detroit, ostensibly, I guess, in support of the workers, saying, oh, I have your back, something like that. And there's worry from Michigan Democrats that, you know, the party is potentially getting lapped by Donald Trump, especially on the optics front, if not so on the policy front. And of course, optics are a very important thing in politics, so that is something that we will be following over the course of these next couple of weeks, and the strike more generally as it goes along. Now, before we get to everything else, I also want to mention this very quickly, the whole, you know, federal government's about to shut down because the House can't pass anything to save their lives. I'm going to cover all that in a specific episode coming out tomorrow. So just the gist of it is, let's just say I'm going to be having a lot of words for Speaker Kevin McCarthy tomorrow. And that's all I'll say on that. So let's get to the other news stories of the week. We go to Portland, Oregon for our next story. Mayor Ted Wheeler, much maligned by the left, especially after the months and months of Black Lives Matter protests that were some of the most heated across the nation. He is not running for a third term. He is not running for re-election in, I believe, 2023. I believe the election is in November, could be 2024, but it was on September 13th, so that was essentially last week when he announced this, that it is to the 2024 Portland elections. He is not running for a second or third term. And, you know, Portland politics, I mean, there was sort of a backlash against progressives in Portland, not just on, you know, the whole aftermath of the protests, but also the city's homelessness crisis and stuff of that nature. So it will be interesting to see which direction Portland goes. And that is something that we will probably be following in the next couple of years. So we go over to Michigan for our next story. And this story is a bit of a weird story. We've covered some weird stories already, like the McCurtain County situation, you know, last semester. But this story essentially says that, let me try to say it as PG as I can. Because there's, well, let me just say it out front. There's some prostitution going on with a former Michigan House Speaker. So apparently the story goes, at least one lobbyist, and this is in Detroit News, at least one lobbyist had hired a sex worker to, you know, do her job and, well, have sex with the former Michigan House Speaker, Rick Johnson. And that was ostensibly done in order to secure licenses to grow and sell marijuana in Michigan. Now, corruption and prostitution is something that isn't strange to politics. In fact, it's almost normalized. But the fact that this story came out as, you know, Michigan now has a new House Speaker, new House majority, and Democrats are starting to pass policy there at a very rapid rate, and it just, you know, goes to show, you know, more specifically, just what lobbyists will do, what people will do to get their preferred policies passed into law, the preferred policy ideas implemented in either a locality, a state, or a country, that they will resort to hiring sex workers to try and get that done for them. So, yeah, pretty wild story coming out of Michigan there. Now, something that was also wild, and as far as my knowledge goes, I don't think anybody knew this was going to happen until it happened. President Joe Biden tweeted in support of a 25% billionaire tax, and it was just simply like this, quote, "It's time billionaires paid at least a 25% minimum tax." And that's it. Didn't hear any other messaging from the White House about this. Didn't hear anything else other than, you know, either Biden or telling a social media intern, hey, tell the American public I support a 25% billionaire tax. Now, I have a theory for why this might be. Maybe this is to maybe assuage progressive concerns about its candidacy, to maybe lower the Cornel West vote for 2024 as they're looking to a very competitive presidential election against presumptive nominee Donald Trump, trying to essentially get that into essentially the 2024 campaign so that, you know, progressives, if they may not be enthused by Joe Biden, might say, well, there's enough of our policy preferences, there's enough good here for us to where, you know, we will at least be able to hold our noses. Because that's what the Biden administration is trying to do. They're trying to get that coalition as wide as they can. And, you know, again, it's a very real concern. Youth voters, progressive voters, not turning out the same clip that more moderate or especially more conservative voters might turn out. And that is something that, if not the White House, then President Joe Biden and his re-election team are at least trying to make some efforts to. And I'll talk about another effort at the end of this podcast episode. So moving on to Texas now, one of the bigger news stories of the week. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton got acquitted of all of his charges. There was a bunch of charges related to corruption, you know, and bribery and stuff like that, that the Texas State House pretty much voted through pretty quickly. I think it was like 18 or so charges against Ken Paxton. All of them were ultimately dismissed. He was acquitted of all of them by a majority vote in the Texas Senate. Now, the Texas Senate, I believe, is, if I remember correctly, 18 Republicans and 10 Democrats. There could be misjudging. There are 12 Democrats, probably actually 18 Republicans, 12 Democrats. But essentially, only two Republicans voted to convict Ken Paxton and most of those. And you need a two-thirds majority to convict in the Texas Senate. And considering they didn't even get a majority, then Ken Paxton walks free and he is resuming duties as Texas Attorney General. Now, one of the other side stories here is that there is a lot of friction between the Texas State House and the Texas Senate. The Texas Senate is run by, you know, you have this Senate Majority Leader, I think, Dade Phelan, and you have Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who operates as the President of the Senate, and then you have the Texas State House, and they are in a lot of, they have been in a lot of friction for a long time. It's too long for me to go into it more specifically. There's also, but, you know, issues like school choice and stuff like that, that a Texas Senate, like, really might want done, but, like, the Texas House, with a lot of more like rural representatives, might object to. Of course, with all Democrats not wanting Governor Greg Abbott's agenda to be passed into law in the first place. So we'll move on from Texas in a little bit. I've already talked about Texas enough on this podcast, trust me. And we'll go over to Florida, where Matt Gaetz has been in the news for, well, not, you know, running for things. He's been in the news for the whole shutdown and continuing resolution debacle. But apparently he's angling to run for Florida's governorship in 2026, trying to succeed Governor Ron DeSantis, who will be, I think, ineligible to run for a second term in 2026. Now, the reporting from NBC News on September 18th, so this past Monday, says that Matt Gaetz is, quote, 100% in on a 2026 gubernatorial race. So, of course, the far-right representative is, well, obviously very controversial. He has a lot of scandal that I am not going to go into, but is generally pretty popular with the Republican voter base, especially in Florida at this point. Pretty toxic amongst, you know, more moderate, you know, voters, though. He was one of the big underperformers in 2022, along with, you know, fellow Representative Anna Paulina Luna. Matt Gaetz represents the Florida Panhandle, so Pensacola, Destin, Fort Walton Beach, that sort of stuff. Anna Paulina Luna represents northern Pinellas County, north of St. Petersburg, and northwest of Tampa. So you have Matt Gaetz, who is apparently going to be 100% in. You also have a fellow Florida Republican representative in Byron Donalds, who has quickly shot up the ranks in House Republican leadership. Now, he represents, I believe, parts of Southwest Florida, like Naples, and I think like Cape Coral and areas like that. And he had confirmed to reporters of the Daily Mail and other reporters that he's also thinking about running for Florida governor in 2026. So you look ahead outside of 2024 to 2026, there might be a really heavily contested and heated primary in Florida in 2026, and that will probably happen after I leave my post here. So unfortunately, I don't think I'll be able to talk about this more as that election goes in, and also that's 3 years from now. So, and who knows what the country is going to look like 3 years from now? Who knows what this country is going to look like 1 month from now? But there's something to think about as these, you know, House representatives are starting to try to, essentially, what is the word that I'm looking for? Trying to move their chess pieces in order to think about their future political aspirations and what they might want to do. Of course, you know, I'll be talking a lot more about Matt Gaetz himself in regards to that other debacle that I'll talk about tomorrow. So we just got a few more news stories before we head out. We have the Pennsylvania governor, Josh Shapiro, announcing on Tuesday that he has implemented a form of automatic voter registration. Now, the announcement was, I believe, and we'll pull it up right here, is that Governor Shapiro, who beat Doug Mastriano in 2022 by like over 15 points, it wasn't even close, in that Shapiro is now using administrative authority, or basically executive power, to implement automatic voter registration at the Pennsylvania DMV. Basically, when you get your driver's license, you'll be automatically registered to vote. So that is going to be something that will be crucial in 2024 as we take a look at, you know, different voting laws, which ones are more lax, which ones allow more people to vote and stuff of that nature. So that is something that will be heavily considered in a state that is likely going to determine who wins the presidential election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, assuming they both make it to Election Day alive. Now, we go back to the U.S. House and go back to sort of these characters that are telling the story in the continuing resolution debacle, but this one is just a bit more to do with the potential resignation. Representative Ken Buck, who is a Freedom Caucus member and was really thinking about voting against Kevin McCarthy, I don't think he ended up doing so, but he voted against the whole debt limit increase thing, along with like 70 other or so Republicans, and he is surprisingly one of the biggest Republican critics of the campaign to impeach Joe Biden. And he's apparently thinking about leaving Congress for a job at CNN. And Ken Buck himself confirmed this to Stephen Nelson of the New York Post. And he said the timing of his exit remains unclear. He's exploring various options. So it seems pretty likely that Representative Ken Buck, he represents Eastern Colorado. You know, a lot of Weld County is in that district as well. He's thinking about retiring to take a job elsewhere. So if he does, we'll tell you about it and who might run and that sort of stuff as well. Now, look forward to Sunday's episode before we end it off here. We're going to be talking a lot about special elections in 2023. And all I'll say on this whole thing, the gist of what Sunday's episode is going to be about, is that polls and special elections, the results that we're getting from both of them do not match up with one another. The polls are saying right now, and this is just right now, things can change, but the polls are saying that Donald Trump will get enough of the popular vote to win the Electoral College. But the special elections are pointing to a Democratic tsunami. And I'm not sure which one of those is more accurate. And I'll talk about that more on Sunday. The reason why I bring that up is because there are two pretty important special elections if you live in New Hampshire and Pennsylvania on Tuesday. There is a Rockingham-based House district in New Hampshire that was narrowly won by Trump by less than a point. It's left trending, but is historically a rock-ribbed Republican district that voted for Chris Sununu by over 20 points last year, but the Democratic candidate beat the far-right GOP candidate. And I say far-right because essentially the Republican candidate's a QAnon believer. I think that's as best as I can describe it. But the Democrat ended up winning that race by 12 points. And what that means in New Hampshire is that should the Democrats be able to fill one of their own empty seats in Coos County. It's a Biden by 11 seat that just opened up a few days before this recording. If they're able to fill that up, if they're able to win that, then they will have tied the New Hampshire State House. And given that another seat has opened up due to another resignation in the New Hampshire State House, the Trump by 8 district, I believe, I can't remember if it's in like Stafford or Carroll County. I'll have to double check. But if Democrats win both of these incoming special elections in the New Hampshire State House, then they will have taken nominal control of the State House, with the New Hampshire State House being at about like 400 members, which, again, I've talked about this before, the New Hampshire State House being 400 members for like a state of like, what, 2 million people is frankly absurd, but that creates a situation where actual control of the State House of what gets passed and what doesn't basically just depends on who's absent. So you can get some really funky votes here and there, especially with 400 House members. You get a lot more representatives, and you get a lot more ideological diversity, maverickism, and stuff of that nature. So it is something to watch. Also, moving out of New Hampshire, now we go to Pennsylvania, where the Democrats won a special election in the Pittsburgh area to fill former State Representative Sari Namorado's seat. She is running and is likely going to be the next executive of Allegheny County, so she resigned to focus on that race, and the Democrats ended up overperforming Joe Biden's margin by double digits in that special election as well. That means that Democrats have retaken control of the Pennsylvania State House. So it just makes it somewhat easier for Governor Josh Shapiro to get some of the agenda that he wants passed. So that is something to watch as well. But the things that I'm going to be focusing on tomorrow is the fact you have these huge overperformances that are constant for Democrats, and yet the polls are showing a tied presidential election. Which one is right? We don't know. We'll be discussing that more on Sunday, though. So finally, to end this off, this was announced on the morning of the recording that President Joe Biden is going to be starting to fulfill a key demand of the Green New Deal, which is a policy proposal that has been going around for years by Democratic socialists and environmentalist groups. And it's so essentially, you know, the Civilian Climate Corps, you know, proposal that is essentially being put into place on sort of a smaller scale to begin with. So the Biden administration is launching the first ever American Climate Corps. So the White House is saying that, quote, this will be a workforce training and service initiative aimed at preparing American youth for jobs in clean energy and climate resilience. So again, another thing to potentially assuage, you know, progressive criticisms over Joe Biden, especially on his climate policy. They were really upset when the Biden campaign did announce, you know, the Willow Project in Alaska that Representative Mary Peltola, a Democrat from Alaska, was pushing for, as were other Alaska politicians in a bipartisan manner. But that really got a lot of anger from a lot of climate activists. And the Biden administration, over the past month, has been trying to work to assuage those concerns as well. So the National Climate Advisor for the White House, Ali Zaidi, said, quote, it will put to work a new diverse generation of more than 20,000 Americans. Quote, in many cases, they'll be doing the important tasks of conserving and restoring our lands and waters, bolstering community resilience, deploying clean energy, which Zaidi adds, quote, in many cases distributed and community-based, also implementing energy efficiency technologies that will be aimed to cut consumer costs and advancing environmental justice so long overdue in so many places, again, according to Ali Zaidi. So apparently there'll be a wide range of jobs for this. So you have restoring coastal wetlands, you have forest management to help fight wildfires, and to help build out clean energy project as well. Now, this idea was first, so remember going back to 2020, when you had the Biden and the Bernie team sort of meet together to craft a basically a unity campaign task force to craft the Biden agenda for the 2020 presidential election and for his now term as president. So this climate core was a part of that, and it is something that the Biden administration has finally gotten around to doing. So we'll of course see where that goes, but that is where we're going to end off this news flash. Thank y'all for watching. Tomorrow and Sunday are going to be very, very heavy days, so be prepared for that, and we'll see you tomorrow for discussions of whatever is going on in the U.S. House, because good Lord, there is a lot.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.